This is Fresh Air, a new interview program, and I'm Terry Gross. My guest is comedian and actor Joe Piscopo. During his 3.5 years as a cast member of Saturday Night Live, his celebrity impressions became one of the show's greatest attractions. He did Frank Sinatra, David Letterman, David Hartman, Joan Rivers. He also created original characters like the manic sportscaster and the husband in the constantly complaining couple Doug and Wendy Weiner. Since leaving the show in the spring of 1984, Joe Piscopo has had several firsts in his career. His first comedy special on HBO, his first feature film, Johnny Dangerously, and his first book, The Piscopo Tapes. When I spoke with him, I asked him when he began developing his showbiz and TV star characterizations.
When I did Saturday Night Live, surprisingly enough, only because I used to fool around with a character or two doing stand-up at the Improvisation in New York. But Saturday Night Live, out of necessity, they said, Joe, we need somebody to do, for example, the first show that I did on Saturday Night Live. And I guess it was 1980, I guess, after they fired they made that smart move at NBC and fired everybody, like Billy Murray and everybody, and brought in us new geniuses. Whew, that was tough. But then they said, you got to do Jimmy Carter and Johnny Anderson. So I said, okay, and I did them. And it was this out of fear. But then it just kind of snowballed after that.
I know that you don't like to call them impressions, but rather characterizations. Yeah. What don't you like about impressions?
Because I always picture a guy in a lounge turning around going, okay, oh, no, this is it. Okay, Bogart. I saw one of my press release somebody put out, Impressionist Joe Piscopo. I primarily consider myself an actor, you know, because I started out, all I want to do is act. I enjoy acting, you know, and the comedy thing just came about because of Saturday Night Live. And, I guess it's that Vegas thing, you know. But I do impressions. I can't deny that.
Let's talk about some of the characterizations you do. Why don't we start with Sinatra? Why did you want to do Sinatra? Had he had his singing been important, or is he just such the icon that you thought he'd be fun to do?
Yeah, exactly that. He was the icon that I thought would be fun to do because I was brought up on him. And I've said this before, Terry. I, being from New Jersey and being Italian, Frank's picture was in every barbershop I've ever gone in. You know, it was like he and Dean Martin and the Pope at the time. And I just grew up to love him and admire him so much. And then I always dug the music, just had an instinct, and could always identify Frank Sinatra music when I was a little kid even. So it was, I don't know whether it was the Nelson Riddle, Billy May arrangements, what it was, but I just always identified the Frank Sinatra music and dug it. Just, you know, you listen to something, you go, I like this, and I liked it. And then when I was doing my audition tape for Saturday Night Live, I just being the wacky person that I am, I broke into a rendition of I Don't Stand a Ghost of a Chance with You. I remember looking into the camera and I said, I don't stand a ghost of a chance with you. And I did it like that. And then somebody said, hey, you do Sinatra. I said, no. I was just fooling around. And they said, no, you do Sinatra. And I said, oops. So I ended up doing him on the show again because someone asked. Right. And then I studied him. Don't get me started on Sinatra. My God, I could go on for hours. To get him better, I studied his voice. I studied every part of his music. I studied all of his records. And I got to appreciate him even more. And there is no way that anyone could tell me that he is not the greatest entertainer of all time. Elvis, the Beatles included. Honestly. Wes Springsteen gives him a run for his money, though.
Did you study videotapes of him and
everything.
Films?
Name it. So, a person, everything.
What do you look for when you're looking at a videotape before, say, doing Sinatra or another characterization?
Well, with another characterization like Ted Koppel, for example, someone that hasn't been in the public's eye for a while, or to my eye, you know, in turn for my eye, I look for something to latch onto, a hook. Andy Rooney, his voice, you know, to hook in the tilt of his head. But with Sinatra, there was nothing really to latch onto, so you just have to play the tape over and over again until you absorb it. And I don't mean to make it sound like I'm taking myself too seriously, but I'm real technical, you know, and I like to have a technical hook, and I didn't have one with Sinatra. So you have to watch that over and over again, and sure enough, when after a while, I think I absorbed the persona, I think. Who knows?
Well, there are things that I've noticed about Sinatra from watching you do him, such as the tilt of his head when he sings, and how he sometimes leans forward, but in his early days he'd lean back.
Yeah, that's interesting. I got those things I watched for, and the shoulders, lift the shoulders up and drop the shoulders down, which is neat to you know, punctuate a horn or something like that. I guess there were some things that I did hook onto, but a lot of it, I just watched them over and over, and I'd stand there in front of the TV. My boy was like, when I first started doing them, was like 2 or 3 years old. Must have thought I was nuts. So don't you know, after we did the HBO special this past summer, my son started doing, we did the heavy metal version of Witchcraft. Sinatra doing that, and I got my little Joey running around the house in a tuxedo. It's hysterical. People may think it's sick. I think it's hysterical. He's doing Sinatra with all the motions and everything.
Do you practice in front of mirrors?
Yeah, you got to practice in front of mirrors. And a lot of the time, if I do an original character, like in my special, I did this drummer character, and I didn't know where I was going with that, but I sit down, and I have to credit Kevin Haney, my makeup artist, who is just a genius. Gee, I got to tell you, Terry, he is just a genius. Do I make the point? He is a genius. I mean, no, Joe, what do you mean? He's a genius. But he is. And I would sit there in a chair and say, what are we doing today? And we'd be out on camera in a half hour, and we'd just create something.
What kind of shadings do they do on your face for makeup?
Oh, man, name it. I used to walk out of those Saturday Night Live studios, my face burning red, because they do everything. And we used to make those changes in like 2-3 minutes. That was wild. It was fun, though, to do it in those days. Sometimes we did it by a 60-watt bulb backstage. You know, someone else was doing a sketch. That was fun.
Did you think twice about doing David Letterman, since he's more of a peer than the other people
exactly.
that you do?
Yeah, I did, only because I'm a big fan. And he is so hip. He's considered the epitome of where my head is at, where, you know, millions of college people's heads are at. So I thought, I said, geez, I wonder, is this going to be interesting? I said, yeah, man. I said, he's no different than anybody else. If I can do Frank Sinatra, I'm doing Letterman. And I watched Letterman, and Letterman was the hardest of all to get because he's so nondescript. It's like, what are you going to do? This guy from Midwest, you put the thing in the gap in the teeth. But I was in the shower, and I remember the first thing I said getting Letterman was, just came in. I said, Paul Schaefer and the band, ladies and gentlemen. I kept saying, Paul Schaefer and the band. Again, I see my son. He was like young at the time, too. We started doing it, and my son's like, Paul Schaefer and the band, ladies and gentlemen. Bizarre household, Terry, let me tell you.
What about David Hartman? What's the trait in him that you were able to pick up to define him?
I didn't know what I was going to do until, again, Kevin put the makeup on. And he put some lids on, and that was about all the prosthetics we used. And he put some teeth, you know, some teeth. And I went out there, and I didn't know I was going to do it, but I just started going, you know, David does, good morning, duh. And then, of course, I exaggerated it because I got a laugh. And being the disciplined actor that I am, I went for it, you know. And I just started going, duh. And I don't know, it's just something I saw in David Letterman. But I feel so guilty doing that because he is such an intelligent, great guy. I worry about people watching and being offended, you know, because he's a nice man, you know.
Well, has he told you anything?
He was a fan. He had me on Good Morning America.
Doing the impression?
Yeah.
Oh, I missed it.
And, you know, he was just a fan. He was just great and everything. And then I was going to do him on the HBO special. I was going to do him on a Wednesday. We were going to start taping the special. And one of the first things I'll do with David Hartman, phone rings on Tuesday. I'm home, resting, getting ready to shoot the special. It's David Hartman. Calls me up. And he said, Joe. And he told me, he got a fan letter from somebody called Piscopo. And he said, oh, is he related to this guy, Joe? And I went, no. I said, yeah, David, I'm doing you on the special tomorrow. You know? Hoping he would say, duh, I don't mind, go ahead. But I went by it, and I hope he doesn't mind. But it's all in fun, though, right?
Could you imagine anybody doing you?
Yeah, you know what? I did. And I know exactly the way I would do myself, too. I know exactly. I'm telling you, if I was on Saturday Night Live now, I'd do a Joe Piscopo impression just because I feel I'm, like, ripe to do. And I know I would be not too far from David Hartman because I'm like this big doofus guy that walks around and goes, hello, I'm Joe Piscopo. I'm my little boy. Duh, duh. And that, you know, I love everything. Everything's fine. I'm just grateful to be where I am. Yes, Eddie Murphy's my best friend. Duh. I mean, you could do a number on me, man. Big number on me. And or you could just have this face. I guess I just thought of this now. But, you know, if you did a Joe Piscopo impression for prosthetics on my face. Look at this face. It's like rubber, man. You could have, like, my face melt or something.
Do you do any facial exercises so that you can, seriously, so that you can control different muscles and contort your face into other people's faces?
No, not you got to do the face. You mean, yeah, I guess I do, I make faces, but not exercises, not like doing Letterman exercise. One, two, three, ladies and gentlemen.
Did you used to do like your uncle and your teacher when you were younger?
I guess I did. I never really thought about it, but I guess I did do, I can't remember. Oh, you know who I used to do? Mr. Giamavo, God rest his soul. Mr. Giamavo, I'm going to do him yet too. And he just passed away, and I'm telling you, it really crushed me because we have a house. My parents have a house down at the Jersey Shore. And I had my best friend lived right next to me. And Mr. Giamavo was across the street, and it was like the closest thing. I'm from the suburbs of New Jersey. But going down in the summertime was the closest thing to a neighborhood, you know? It was a real old-time neighborhood. And the Williams are there, and the Giamavos, and the Katzes were next door. And we had, we still go down. It's like a big family. And then, unfortunately, Mr. Gio died this past year, and it was like, whoa, it really blew me away because it was like part of my childhood. He was such a character. He used to sit on his front porch. He's Sicilian in every sense. And he would sit on his front porch, and he had this big, gruff voice talk like this. Hey, Joey, how's the surfing? The surfing. He came from Brooklyn. Surfing. Oh, that. You would talk like that, and he'd go to the track. Hey, boys, we'd be going out with some girls or something like that. You want to go to the track? We'd say, no, Mr. Gio, thank you. And he just would wave his hand and go, bah! <Like that. laughs> Mr. Giamavo. And then he used to smoke Salem cigarettes. I never forget. And he'd take this drag of cigarette, and he'd puff his cheeks out and go, and just look, and he had one glass eye, so you never knew which eye, you know, you were looking at. He was looking at you through. And what a marvelous, wonderful character. So one day I'm going to do him, you know. He's heavy set, big arms, like Popeye, you know.
Would he have beat you up if he had seen you doing it?
No, you know, he had a heart of gold. Heart of gold. he really did have a heart of gold. I think he would have kind of dug it. I'm sorry I didn't have a chance to do him that, where he could have seen it.
Have you ever taken voice lessons?
No. Oh, actually, you know what? I took two, I think. I went to a teacher, and she said, okay, you have to go, ma, me, me, mo, moo. You ever hear people do that? So I'm doing it like Sinatra. Ma, baby, me, mo, moo, you. Hey, you know, and she's going, no. She's telling me that Sinatra sang Strangers in the Night wrong because he said night. Every music teacher tells you that. He should say night. It should be night. And I'm going, night. He's going, no. That, I said, look, I don't think I should be here. I said, you're marvelous, baby, but I got a split. And she said, I think you should. And so now I'm doing a Sinatra impression. If I took the lessons, I wouldn't have been able to do the impression. That was so weird. Oh, and I can't stand those singers that sing like this. I won't say night, I'll say night. Get off the stage, pal.
Let's talk about Saturday Night Live. How much did you want to get on the show when you were auditioning for it? How important was it to you then?
I didn't at all, Terry. I'll tell you straight out, honestly, I didn't at all. It was, I knew the chore they were undertaking, replacing the original, awesome, legendary Saturday Night Live. And I went in with such a lackadaisical attitude. I'm sure that's why I got the job. I just was so, like, it was just like this blank me attitude, you know, that I'm sure that I'm positive they said, geez, look how cool this guy is. Because in my head, I'm going, this is the last thing I want to do is replace Billy Murray on Saturday Night Live. What? Who can? We didn't. And I was right. My instincts are right. And I remember Woody Allen came in at the time, looked at the tapes because he was friends with Gene Domanion, who was the producer. And then they just narrowed it down to that wonderful cast of 80-81, that unforgettable cast of 1980-81. Oh.
That season was a disaster.
To say the least.
Well, how much control did you have? I mean, did you ever want to get on the air and say,
yeah,
I would have preferred other sketches, but this is what we're doing this week.
Exactly. Exactly. Yes, yes. To answer the question, absolutely. I wanted off that show. I'll never forget Jean. I shouldn't be telling you this stuff, but I don't think she'll mind. She was so... It got so crazy after the first or second week. It was obviously a failure. And Jean Domanion is the sweetest person in the world. Wonderful person. But she wanted me to do a sketch called Leather Weather, where they were going to strap me on a weatherboard. It was a play on words. I'll tell you, it was like this all the time. It was terrible. They were going to strap me on a weatherboard with leather bikinis on. And that's all. And a girl with a whip saying leather, like a S&M type of leather. And I said, I'm not doing this. I said, I can't do it. And by that time, she had some featured players on. And I'll never forget, she said to me, well, you know, she mentioned one of those featured players' name, so-and-so also does impressions, Joe. You know, like threatening me. I'll never, ever forget that. And I was real close at that point. It was about the second or third week of saying, well, I think you better go get him, you know. But I ended up not doing the sketch. But boy, oh boy, that was weird. Isn't that weird? And that's the kind of stuff that went down. It was very strange.
What were the reasons that you were all given for the change in actors from the one season to the next? Because you and Eddie Murphy were the only two people held over for the new Saturday Night Live.
The reaction? They said that they thought Eddie and I had potential and everybody else just wasn't working. Boy, they did fire everybody, didn't they? Wow, yeah, I remember that day, too. That was a wild day. That was like me and Eddie walking around. Eddie, I didn't care, you know. We didn't care. It was a bomb show. We were lucky to get out alive. I mean, we were ruining. The show was ripping down a television institution. And I was such a big I am such a big television fan. Oh, my God. So me and Eddie saying, hey, this is over. This is great. We're cruising around that day. And Dick Ebersole came in, and he finally let the right. And everybody's crying, you know. And, oh, it was terrible. Me and Eddie are hysterical. Isn't that terrible? That's a sick attitude Eddie and I have, I guess. Look at everybody. It's unbelievable. You know? And Dick called us in and said, well, you fellas, you know, we're going to keep you guys around. We're going to give you another chance. You better be good. We're bringing in these Second City people, and you better be good because they're going to blow you off the screen. So... A lot of them got fired since then. But I got to write a book one day. Oh, God.
Were you sorry that you were kept? Or were you happy?
I was ambivalent. Matter of fact, Michael O'Donohue came in at the time. Everybody calls him brilliant. And I guess Michael is brilliant in his own way. And he came in and he told me to my face, you do a decent Sinatra, but you don't knock me out. This is when he was bringing in all, you know, this was after everybody got fired and they were going to put in a new cast. So I wanted to leave. So I called my then manager and I said, let me out. You know, I said, they don't want me there. I don't want to be there. If Michael Donahue doesn't want me there. So he called NBC and he got some feedback and stuff. And he said, no, stick it out. And it was great advice, really, because I'm glad I did stay with the show. I learned more there at Saturday Night Live. And I'm so grateful to the original cast now, as I left, how gracious they were. You know, Gilda Radner never said anything, you know, like, what are they doing to my show? And it just gave me a chance to learn. It was great.
Why did you leave?
I left because a lot of opportunities came up, and I didn't have, it was either do the opportunities or go back on Saturday Night Live. And I was ready to go back to Saturday Night Live, but my agent said, don't go back. He said, you shouldn't go back. You've done all that they'll let you do on the show, and I don't think you should go back. And I think it was good advice. So now I'm having such a ball. I have such... I'm so, like, peaceful now. You know what I mean? I still have that drive and everything. But I just feel very at ease, and I don't have that maniacal thing. Geez, what am I going to do this week? Live television. I think I did almost 4 years of that. I could get to anybody.
How much of your own material did you write on Saturday Night Live?
Most of it. I would say about 98%.
Did you have things that you would do to... get yourself in the right mood to write when the comedy wasn't coming, but you were getting closer to Saturday?
Yeah, it was the worst thing. And usually you go into Saturday dry, you know, and then you wouldn't be on the show.
What would you do? Would you eat or go to the movies or?
No, I'd sit in my office in a catatonic stupor.
Do exercise or just sit there?
Just sit there. I tried exercising. I tried everything. I tried going out to dinner. but I would just sit there and stare at my bulletin board. And it was probably the worst thing I could have done. I should have hopped in the car and gone for a drive or something. But it was tough.
Can you tell me how you developed the Doug and Wendy Weiner characters?
That's me. Robin Duke and I were in the office, in my office, at Saturday Night Live. And no one was writing for us, as usual. I shouldn't say that. There were some people that did write for you occasionally. But most of the time, they didn't. They wrote, like, these generic sketch, cast sketches, when you needed that one little piece, you know, that strong piece. And I was like, going, I can't believe the writers aren't writing for me. What do I got to do for these people? And Rob was going, I don't know. Why is it not writing for me either? And we said, wait a minute. It was as simple as that, Terry. I'm telling you. And then we're like, we'll do the Weiners. No, we'll watch. What? Yeah, well, why? Well, why? And we did it. Wasn't that unbelievable? And I don't know. But that's me. I was a Weiner as a child. And now, even now at home, you know, to my son, you know, why are you making so much noise? I'm a Weiner. Yeah. But it came out of complaining about not having material written for us. And really genuinely complaining. And then Robin and I just complained to each other and putting the characters into action, you know.
Oh, they're great. One of the things they always complain about is their diverticulitis. Do you have friends, neighbors, aunts, uncles who
Robin
have it?
Robin Duke's grandfather had it. Or someone she knew had it. I didn't even know what it was. And she goes, oh, you could have diverticulitis. I said, sure, that's a funny... It was a funny word to say, diverticulitis. It's a good Weiner word, you know.
When you were in high school, what did you expect to be when you grew up?
An actor or a lawyer. I really knew I enjoyed acting because I worked at the stage there in West Essex High School in North Caldwell, New Jersey. It was a great stage. I had a drama coach named Charles E. Gaunt. I did him on the show once. I don't know if it worked, but people, it was a lot of fun, huh? Chuck was great, man. Rest his soul. All my heroes are dying good. And Chuck used to have a big butt. And a big gut, and a double chin, and he'd put his hands on his hip backwards, and he had a slight limp. And he would come over and say, Joey, how the hell are you? Oh, you look good today, lad, huh? Are you cutting class? Yeah, Chuck, I am. Well, I didn't see you, okay? And then if we were lagging in the play, we were lagging, he'd always do this. Come on, people, pick it up, will you, huh? Come on, people. Chuck Gaunt was great. So, Chuck introduced me to theater, and if it was up to Chuck, he would have introduced me to other things, but fortunately, he didn't, and I just became a real theater buff. He was a marvelous man with a great, vast knowledge for theater and for stage presence. He was a brilliant actor, and I learned more from him than I'll ever learn from anybody.
Did you go to a college that specialized in theater?
No, you know what? Chuck was going to get me into NYU. I got suspended 8 times from high school. Whoops, sorry. 8 times from high school I got suspended, if you can believe it.
For what?
Name it.
Okay.
Name something, and I'm sure I did it.
Smoking in the halls.
Smoking in the halls, disciplinary problems.
Holding out a switchblade in class. How's that?
okay, you got me. I was never a bad guy like that.
So you never made it to NYU.
I never made it to NYU, but Chuck could have gotten me in. But the reason I didn't like it was because I was more of a jock, and I didn't like the theatrical type. I don't know if I could have taken a class full of Chuck Gaunts.
And how'd you get into the comedy clubs?
Yeah, I went on a Sunday night. I knew the improvisation had an audition night. And I said, I'm going to put 5 minutes of comedy together. Just thought, you know, I got to give this a shot. I don't know what drive made me do it, but I got together 5 minutes of stand-up, and I hopped in my Oldsmobile Cutlass, went down 9th Avenue. I looked at the improvisation on 44th and 9th. There were about 200 auditioners lined up all the way down 9th Avenue. I didn't even get out of the car. I went right to the Lincoln Tunnel on 9th Avenue. And I said, I can't do this. This is crazy. But as the week went by, I said, yeah, I better try it. I went back the next week at noon. There was only 2 or 3 people in line at that point. But even still, at noon, the show opened, the club opened at 8:30 that night, and we would spend a whole day sitting in our cars. It was cold. It was February 1976. And boy, oh boy, I just got up and did the 5 minutes, and I did better than I thought I would. I mean, there were some laughs, But still, all in all, bad. I did all dirty material.
Oh, so you can't tell any of it now?
No, were you going to just ask that? No, I'd be even embarrassed to tell you what I did. I couldn't even tell, even off mic, I would be embarrassed to tell you what I did. I can't believe I did that stuff on stage. But I did, and after three or four times at the going to Catch a Rising Star and the improvisation, they asked me back at the improv, and I said, wow, I'm a regular. So I went thinking, hey, this is great, I'm going to be a regular. That meant hanging around till 3 o'clock in the morning, waiting till Elaine Boozler and Andy Kaufman went on, and Freddie Prinze and David Brenner. So there was always a pecking order, right? So, but finally, after about a couple of years, I started emceeing the shows, and little by little, you know.
Different ethnic groups have different comic traditions. Like for Jewish comics, there's the whole Borscht Belt tradition of Catskill nightclub comedians. Is there like any Italian tradition of comedians that you feel a part of?
No. I don't, although I do Italian humor in my act. I felt I didn't change my name.
I was just going to ask you about that, because a lot of people do change their name because they don't want it to sound ethnic.
Yeah, I didn't change. I think about it now. Maybe I should have, because Piscopo is a terrible, horrible name for me. I should be kidded about the first three letters of the name, you know. But in any case, all I could think of was my grandfather having enough guts to get on the banana boat, if you will, and come over to Newark, New Jersey, and work in a hat factory in New York. And my father struggling, going to law school. And what would they think if I changed? I mean, I really sound hokey here. But I don't know. I just feel obligated to keep my... I felt obligated to do it, you know, so... You know, it's weird. I always wanted to call myself Joe Parker.
Oh, yeah.
Isn't that weird? I wrote a sitcom that one day I will produce called Joe Parker. A great little show, but a great name. Isn't that a great name? Joe Parker.
An Anglican name, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. And it would have looked great with Eddie Murphy and Joe Parker. I always thought of that, you know? Like, I thought that would have been neat.
What are some of the hazards of the trade when you're a comedian? Besides, like, the stress of having to face performances all the time.
I don't know if there are any. It's hard for me to say. I don't think there are any. Coming up with new material.
How about people wanting to prove to you how funny they are?
That's getting weird. It's getting weirder now. I don't know what it is, but yeah, people do that. I had a car driver to me telling me. He actually said to me, "Hey, Joe, you ever hear me? My name." He gives me his name. You know, he goes, "Yeah, I do some singing too. I go down with Caesars down there in Atlantic City." And I said, "Oh, what, did you play the room down there?" "No, well, actually, I did a guest shot with the lounge band down there. I sang New York. I do all Sinatra stuff," he told me. I said, "Oh, great. Well, you'll be going places." I said, "It worked for me," you know. Anyway, no hazards. I'm at a very good point in my life now, Terry, because I'm not a major star. I'm a celebrity, you know. I'm just a celebrity, and I'm not like... people in the street are very friendly. They still, "Hey, Joe, how are you?" Hit me in the back, shake my hand. "Hey, man, I really appreciate your work." And it's not like wild or anything. And there's a demand, but it's not where it's going to interfere. I'm telling you, if it could stay like this, this is all I ever wanted. It's all I ever stayed those 8.5 hour Sundays for at the improvisation, for what I'm doing right now.
Comedian and actor Joe Piscopo. I hope you enjoyed this edition of Fresh Air. Fresh Air is produced at WHYY Radio in Philadelphia. The technical director was Joyce Lieberman. Fresh Air is edited by associate producer Maeve McGoran. Danny Miller and I co-produced the show. My name's Terry Gross. Thanks for listening.
National distribution of Fresh Air is made possible by support from the University of Pennsylvania in Philadelphia and its 16 undergraduate, graduate, and professional schools. Additional funding comes from National Public Radio member stations and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is NPR, National Public Radio.